KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on the last show of this fall quarter on KZSU's schedule. I'm very pleased and excited to have on Professor John Palfrey of Harvard Law School, the author or co-author of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. The book is co-authored with Urs Gasser, who is not joining us today. In Born Digital, John takes a look at what we do and how we should handle this generation of youth that are being born in a world that is quite different than the world in which he and I and people our age grew up in. What is this technology doing to children across the board? And not just children, but also, of course, their parents and society. How should we react to the changes in the technology that are occurring really on a daily basis, and how children interact with those technologies? And so in John's book, and I'm going to refer to it as John's book, although again I emphasize that it is co-authored with Urs Gasser, in John's book he touches on a variety of areas ranging from social networking sites to the much more pernicious areas of cybercrime and so forth. What role can parents play? What is the ultimate question or questions that parents should be asking, as well as what can law and the mores of technology do to deal with some of the concerns that we might have when we put children in the hands of technology? And I use that phrase purposely because in many ways what John is describing is that very situation. Technology is driving the student's behavior rather than the other way around. So in Born Digital, we take and John takes a really quite broad look at these questions and takes a very balanced approach at thinking about how policymakers and lawyers in particular, as well as technologists generally and parents should be thinking about these issues. By way of brief background, John is the Harry N. S. Professor of Law and Vice Dean at Harvard Law School. He is a faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University now. I think it was Harvard Law School, but now okay. I think it's Harvard University. Thank you, John. I saw that recently, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm an enormous admirer of the Berkman Center and the Berkman Center's works, and I have a number of friends there, and so I've enjoyed working with Berkman fellows and faculty during my time as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford. He has published extensively on the Internet's relationship to intellectual property, international governance, democracy. He chairs the Internet Safety Technical Task Force, made up of leading internet service companies and nonprofit groups focused on children's safety. He's a regular commentator on many network and cable news programs, and of course he lives in Cambridge. And I'm really an immense admirer of his work, and I'm thrilled to have him on the show. So, John, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on your great podcast.
I appreciate it, John. Let's start off with a question that I ask really all of my guests, especially authors. Talk a little bit more about your background and how you came to focus on these issues.
This is a topic that has both personal and professional appeal for a variety of reasons. I think that both Urs Gasser and I came to the project of thinking about youth and how they interact with technology with three hats on. The first hat is as a parent of two small kids. I had lots of conversations with my wife about how we wanted to raise our kids in a digital era and what we want them to know about related to new technologies, and what are the things that we don't want them to do? What are the pitfalls that we foresee? And so partly this was doing my homework as a parent in public, and Urs Gasser has two children as well, and we were taking the sort of parents first approach. Secondly, we're both teachers as professors in law schools. We have classes of young people, though not as young as our own children, who are using these technologies as the core way of learning and interacting with institutions. And it's a very different world teaching young people today, I think, than it was a generation ago. And that is a set of puzzles that I think are going to face teachers and librarians and others who interact with students on a regular basis. And then third, we approached it as lawyers in the sense that these are really interesting legal questions. You know this well through your own work as a teacher in the space and as a researcher, that these are thorny and interesting problems that law in the traditional sense doesn't solve really easily. The kinds of issues like spam, for instance. How do you stop spam by passing a law? We've had lots of experience of passing things that don't really stop these highly distributed problems. And when it comes to trying to pass laws related to use on the Internet, we face the same issue as we have in lots of other Internet law problems. So it's really with these three different hats on, as a parent, as a teacher, and as a lawyer, that these are both important and interesting questions with which to grapple.
When we think about technology issues, and oftentimes I think it's a good question to ask up front, we read in the mainstream press often of these horrific situations involving crime on the Internet and fraudsters and so forth. And so, especially as parents, and we're going to get into this in more detail in discussion, there is a tendency to think, boy, the Internet is this den of thieves and individuals that are out to get us. And, of course, I know that isn't your perspective, but from a top-level approach, as you write a book like this, how do you address those kinds of concerns in terms of going about writing your book and talking about these issues?
So I think we write the book and offer the book and hopefully the conversations that flow from it in the context of a fair amount of fear-mongering around many of these issues, which I think was kind of a background issue for trying to present it. I feel like those of us who do research in this field have an obligation to try to bring to bear the best of the research that we can get our hands on or do ourselves to the most important public policy issues that are facing our kids. So when we talk about something like Internet safety, this is an issue that is on the minds of virtually every parent and teacher that we certainly talk to. They're coming at it with a view that there are certain kinds of things that we should be afraid about that are not as big a concern as they probably are made out to be in some of the mainstream press. And at the same time, they may not be looking out for some of the challenges that our kids may in fact face. So I think we came at this project from the perspective of trying to be honest brokers with data that we've found that other people have gathered and data that we've gathered ourselves, and then to try to apply it in an even-handed way, saying we get that there are positive and negative aspects to the use of these media, that these things can be good or bad for learning, they can be good or bad for civic involvement and so forth, and that the challenge here is to take a really hard, cold, objective look at research, to do some of that research ourselves, and then to apply it even-handedly to these policy questions with a view toward improving the lives of kids and of our society. So it really was about trying to identify myths that needed busting and myths that had some reality to them, and then to comment on the application of that research to those policy questions.
You mentioned, of course, your background as a professor and being in the classroom, and I'm curious, although you acknowledge that the students whom you're teaching are not the core area of interest or the core group of interest in your book, how does your experience in the classroom color your analysis of these issues? I mean, what kinds of thoughts have you had when you teach cyber law issues and when you discuss technology generally at Harvard that have impacted how you've approached this book?
So one of the really big differences, I think, even than when I was a student not that long ago, about a decade ago in law school, is the presence of computers in the classroom. So this may seem trivial, but when you look out on a classroom of students at the Harvard Law School, unless you ban them, pretty much every student will have a laptop in front of them, and they tend to look into the laptop, not up at you as the teacher. You call upon them, and they look up all of a sudden, but otherwise they're looking into a laptop. They might be doing email. They might be looking up the case you're talking about. They might be playing solitaire or hearts with their neighbors, but they're doing multiple things at once. And I think this is one of the very basic things that we have to take up as teachers. Do we want to teach with technology, or do we want to ban the technology in the classroom? There isn't a binary answer to that. It may be that, in fact, sometimes you do one and sometimes you don't. There are times when laptops deserve to be closed, and there are times when experimentation with the tools can be really helpful to learning. But that same question, I think, permeates lots of other aspects of teaching. So in the context of a library, I'm a library director here at the Harvard Law School, and one of the things that we know is that students don't pull that many books off shelves. They tend to do a Google search to learn something. They tend to look at sources that are untraditional in a legal sense as a first orientation. How do we give them the best possible research skills, the kinds of legal research skills that we've given students for generations to become great lawyers, while also taking advantage of the special things that they know how to do and how they know how to access and participate in the creation of knowledge through internet-mediated devices? So I think those would be two specific examples, one in the classroom and one to do with research, both of which give rise to really hard, interesting pedagogical questions that those of us who are in teaching positions at law schools have to take up.
One of the interesting things I think about your book, as we think about it, the top level, of course, are the chapter names, and each one has a single name, and I think it's useful to contextualize the discussion for listeners to identify these chapter titles, which begin in order: identities, dossiers, privacy, safety, creators, pirates, quality, overload, aggressors, innovators, learners, activists, and synthesis. And these ideas all do, of course, in one way or another, involve the use of technology or the application of technology in individuals. And in some cases in these titles, you're referring to perhaps a descriptor for an individual. And in others, you're talking about particularly values or principles or issues that those users would have to grapple with. And so I'm curious about, in terms of the topics that you cover and also the ways that you title the chapters, how you approach those issues.
I think the first thing that you noted, or one of the things you noted, and the first thing that I thought of in creating the chapter names was to put the young people themselves first, to say it's not about education so much as it is about the learners. It's about the people who are doing the learning and how we orient our teaching approach to the way that they are seeing the world. In some cases, it's about taking advantage of the great things that they're doing and that others haven't done so much before and which the technology makes possible. In other cases, it's to say, gee, these are some things that they're doing that we don't want them doing so much of, and how do we curb those activities? But it has to start and finish, I think, with the young person as the object and the kind of focus of our attention and orientation. This is true in particular because in a lot of cases, young people themselves are the ones who can help solve the problems most easily. That if, in fact, we can give skills to young people, they make good decisions often, and they also help one another make good decisions. There's a ton of learning that goes on peer-to-peer. This may seem like an obvious point, and it may also seem like a not that helpful point because it's sort of easier said than done, but I think it's important continuously to repeat them. But some of the other ones, which are not so much about the orientation of the person, such as privacy or safety, these are really the words that we heard most through our interviews and focus groups in doing the research. So we approach this project by saying, what is different about growing up now and growing up in an era in which many people who have the good fortune to be in wealthy societies and those who have the good fortune to have the skills to use these technologies are facing that are different than what people have dealt with in the past. And in these interviews and focus groups, both with young people and then with their parents and teachers separately, we kept hearing over and over again concerns about privacy, concerns about safety, and wonderment in some cases about things like creativity and about the ability to be innovative in ways that hadn't come up before. So I think it was sort of a twofold approach to naming these chapters and thinking about our topics. One, of trying to put the young people themselves first, and secondly, to be responsive to the issues that were sort of in the ether, in the discussion, and which seemed to pique the most interest.
And it seems that your jacket design, at least the image on the cover of the book, reflects that, because as best as I can determine, I have a 22-month-old son.
Oh, yeah.
It appears that is a toddler's, at best, hand that is placed on the cover and that is pixelated as you look from left to right. Am I accurate in that reading?
You are, for sure. Yes, I'm no good at design things, but the publisher came up with this design, and I thought it was perfect in terms of the spirit. spirit of the book.
Well, I have a particular interest there because my mother spent her career as a jacket art designer.
Oh, my gosh.
At several publishing houses, so it's one of those things that I always tend to notice, and when we have time, I definitely want to ask about. Well, John, let's with that kind of general background, I guess a couple of more questions about the book broadly, which of course is you know the question of your target audience. I mean, there seems to be some natural candidates, but perhaps you could describe that. Do you have a particular group of individuals or a particular type of person that you would hope would read this book?
We do, in fact, very much so. So when we approached this topic, we were thinking about how could we make the most difference by writing a book? What's the way in which we could be most helpful to our kids, really, and to their friends growing up in their generation? And as we came around to thinking about the data that we had, we thought that the most important audience to reach was, in fact, not policymakers, not lawyers, or the kinds of people we usually talk to, but parents and teachers. And so we were having a drink after having collected all this research and thinking about how do we write it up, how do we put it into an impact or a format that will have an impact on the policy debate. And it became quite clear that we had to have the courage, in a way, as my friend Urs Gasser put it, to write for parents and teachers rather than to write for our natural constituency of other legal scholars and so forth. So we took a risk in this respect. It may be a book that isn't that interesting, for instance, to some technologists who read it and say, these are really familiar issues, and we know all this already, and certainly heard some of that from really great technical people. And likewise, those who are policymakers might look at it and say, you know, gee, a lot of this seems to be saying to parents and teachers, you have an obligation, and less instructive to those who have the ability to amend the law. We have some of that in there, of course, but that's quite right. The idea here is that for parents and for teachers, we think that getting this research into their hands, research that lots of other people have done that we've synthesized, as well as some that we've done our own, and this framing of these issues that we think are very important for the future of our kids is the way that we thought we could have the most impact.
The book itself, last top-level question, comes at a time where we're seeing several books being written focusing on, and not only books, but of course there have been many more articles written in magazines and other journalistic outlets regarding issues involving youth and technology, and particularly the internet. And on Hearsay Culture, for example, I mean, fairly recently, within the last several months, we've had on Morley Winogrand and Mike Hayes, who, as you know, wrote Millennial Makeover, and even more recently, Professor Mark Barreline from Emory, who wrote The Dumbest Generation. And upcoming are authors like Nick Carr, who you know is in his second edition of The Big Switch. Where do you situate Born Digital in this canon of growing literature involving technology and this, as Morley and Mike call it, this generation of millennials?
So I'm delighted to be associated with any canon of any sort. That's fabulous. I think that we didn't have in mind any other particular books as a model or something that we were responding to. I think plainly we take a different view than Professor Barreline does in The Dumbest Generation. I'm not a huge fan of that title, nor really thinking about this itself as a generation, so much as I think it is a population of young people, and also one where I think we see many more of the positive aspects of a free culture, of an internet culture, you know, than, for instance, Professor Barreline does, who I think is writing a book really about concerns and how young people are learning. Many of those concerns are legitimate, but it is a question about what your orientation is and where you think the emphasis lies, and we certainly take a more positive emphasis than he does. I think that many of the other books that have been written, I'd also add the new book by Don Tapscott called Grown Up Digital, which built, I think, on his work of Growing Up Digital before. Mm-hmm. Many of the other ones are focused on different audiences, such as marketers, for instance, or businesses trying to understand how young people are using these technologies. And that's not an orientation particularly that we took in this book. I think it would be relevant to somebody running a business, but we haven't oriented ourselves toward a business audience. And the third difference that I would note to many of the other books written is our emphasis on trying to pull out the best of the research from a range of different fields. So we are not education specialists, as Professor Bauerlein is. We're actually sort of technology guys in a way. And what we've tried to do is to use research from a bunch of different disciplines. It's a challenging task as a scholar, but to sew together things that cognitive psychologists have said, or neuroscientists have said, or lawyers have said, or social scientists who collect a lot of qualitative data have said, and to try to synthesize those different fields into a broad understanding of these issues facing kids. That's a audacious thing for us to have tried to do, but I think it's the right way to try to understand these kaleidoscopically complex questions, and I think that's something that we Hugh, too, and all of our research is trying to be grounded in the best from all the different fields that we can understand, and to try to bring those to bear in a way that, in fact, sheds more light, possibly, than looking at it through a single given microscope.
We're talking to Professor John Palfrey of Harvard Law School, a co-author of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. John, let's talk about more specifics in your book. And you talk about the participation gap, and perhaps you could define that. And you say, you know, in the context of participation gap, you note in your book that it's too simple to say that the Internet amplifies trends that began in the industrial age. You know, so from in terms of situating these issues, in terms of where we are today versus where we've been, I mean, what is that participation gap, and why is it an oversimplification to look at the Internet as an extension of what began with industrialization?
So the issue that we highlight at the end of the first chapter really as the most important one for public policy reasons is the extent to which it's not a generation of young people who are using technology in exactly the same ways, but rather a series of populations. So there's a population that we highlighted as digital natives, those who are using the technology in quite sophisticated ways and in wealthy parts of the world, and people born after 1980. But then on the other side of the participation gap, which is a term coined by a scholar named Henry Jenkins, and then elaborated on by people like Esther Hargitay, who's a professor at Northwestern and a fellow at the Berkman Center as well, are lots of young people who don't have either the access or the skills to do what the more sophisticated colleagues are doing. And as we looked at each of these different key issues, privacy, safety, creativity, and so forth, it was very clear that we run a risk of exacerbating some of the sort of haves and have-nots in other parts of society through this particular process of training some people very well to use these technologies and having others have either less access to them or fewer skills to use them well. So the concern really is to say, if you even if you wire up all the schools and you have everybody have equivalent levels of access, are they going to have the same sophistication of sorting credible information from not credible information, or being careful about what information they put up online about themselves in the context of privacy? Are they as savvy about not meeting people online and then spending time with them offline when that might lead to them getting harmed? And I think the answer is there's real reason to worry about that, that there are digital haves and have-nots with respect to skills, and that's something that I think needs to come into the educational policy debate very squarely in a way that it has not yet to date. So I think that participation gap is really an important one to highlight. It's not a novel thought of our own. We're borrowing from others, but I think it's a crucial reframing of the classic debate over digital divides that we've been having for a decade or more in the Internet zone. So the second point about not just extrapolating forward from the industrial age is to say that there are things different about Internet culture and about the information age that are not just simply the extension of old cultural divisions. We have clearly a culture war around the use of these technologies and discussions about how young people use them and various divides that fall within it, such as this participation gap. But I think that there are slightly different contours to it. So an example might be to say it's sometimes socioeconomic status that divides those who have access from those who don't or the ability to use it. But in many cases, you might look at subpopulations that use the technology in very, very ingenious ways, but then don't, in fact, map to the same kinds of device that you'd expect. One particular one, a very rich culture, is the online hip-hop culture. This is one where you probably wouldn't associate it with hegemony in the socioeconomic sense, but on the other hand, you can find extraordinary things happening online that they're doing in creative ways. So I think it's just simply to say, you can't just simply say, what was the case in the industrial age around various divides is going to repeat itself, though I think we should continuously be worried about other gaps that exist and how they may or may not get exacerbated. So there's tension between those two ideas, of course, but I think it's an important distinction.
We're talking with Professor John Palfrey of Harvard Law School, author of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives with Urs Gasser. On Hearsay Culture, for those of you that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can first go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and contact our underwriting department. And regardless, I do hope, especially in this holiday season, as you are buying gifts for your family and friends, that you consider a small donation to KZSU in that holiday spirit. Somehow I think I've now used the holiday season in a way that may be considered a dangerous approach with respect to donations to KZSU, but I look at it as something at least you may want to think about. John, we're back, and let's talk about these issues in the context of the children, this first generation of digital natives, as you call them. One of the themes in your book is that young people don't have the skills or even they're not at the developmental stage to manage their identities, to sort information, and so forth. Perhaps you could explain that.
So I think that the one of the big issues here is to say that on each of these different topics, you have to break down the universe of young people based on age and based on the specific topic. So I think that if you're thinking about children who are very, very small, you want to consider bringing them up in a way that you're giving them guidance as they use these technologies, and they may be at risk of many of the different things that we talked about. As children grow older, clearly giving them some more room, some more opportunity to use the technologies on their own and without quite so much oversight, very similar to letting them go out into different parts of the world on their own, and different issues become more important. Perhaps encouraging them to use the tools creatively and learning become more crucial, and figuring out how to get more better analytical skills. And by the point at which they're getting ready to go forward into to college and to graduate school, those are points at which, of course, you can't be looking over their shoulder as they use the technology all the time. But it's not that they don't have some issues that are more important to them than others, such as obviously continuing to be safe online and figuring out how to analyze different sources that they find in the online environment.
One of the big themes as well, and we're going to come back to this idea of the direct interaction of this first generation of digital natives with technology, is the question of the biggest challenges and the biggest benefits posed by technology. So, in the panoply of pros and cons that you kind of weigh, to put it simplistically, as we think about whether this technology is good, and I know that that's a annoying word and almost a word that has very little meaning, but in terms of thinking about technology in this good or bad sense, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, is often the approach, what do you see as perhaps the biggest benefit and the biggest challenge to children today? And then I guess I'd ask the same question with regard to their parents.
So I think that the biggest opportunity really is around creativity. This is something that your Stanford colleague Lawrence Lessig has really built a scholarly career on, is pointing to the cultural benefits of a free culture, a culture in which you can remix the items that you come across in your daily life, and increasingly you're coming across in digital format. He's got a recent book called Remix, and I would kind of lean into that argument that says there are very important both critical analytical skills that can be gained from that, learning skills, but also an important ability to retell the story, the narrative of any given culture that previously was held in very few hands and now is held in very many hands, and that young people directly with fairly modest technical skills can do themselves. So I really think that area of creativity, and you might extend that to innovation in business too, it's a different form of creativity, but plainly the ability to do more with less and to do things that have real impact in the world are is something that we should emphasize. I think the biggest concern for kids to me is the flip side of that around learning, that says if in fact you're not using these tools in sophisticated ways, but rather as sort of a gullible person, someone who relies on the first bit of information that they have, that doesn't dig beyond the shallow bits of information that you might come across initially, that you might be ultimately learning less well than if you are more engaged with it and digging in. That the internet can make possible shortcuts that people ought not to take. So I would emphasize this sort of very positive side of interactive learning as a flip side of a more soundbite style culture that I think we don't want to let ourselves slip into, or our young people slip into. I think from the perspective of parents, there are obviously big concerns around safety. So going to the negative part, I think parents have a lot of worry that their kids are going to be abducted by somebody they meet on a social network, for instance. This is something we heard over and over again. I think it's a fear that's very real for many people, and certainly those parents who have had kids harmed in this way have reason to fear it. It's not probably as big an issue in terms of the likelihood of something bad happening as one might perceive from the amount of media attention it gets. On the other hand, there are issues, for instance, bullying online, that is, one where young people clearly are being mean to one another online. There's a whole lot of peer-to-peer psychological harm that's going on, and where, I think parents have very substantial sort of day-to-day reason to worry. On the positive side, I think that the ability to have different kinds of connections with your kids is something that these technologies afford. It's a way that parents can get a window into the culture of their kids and to connect with them. I think for many parents, it's in fact a disengagement. The fear that they're doing bad things on these technologies, or that parents don't understand it, creates a gulf. But I think for those parents who do engage with their children around these issues, who participate together in online spaces, treat them as converged with the offline, as the young people do, I think have opportunities for getting closer to their kids. Think about grandparents also, who are at a greater distance, who can spend more time with their kids through a webcam or through email or instant messaging and otherwise. I think there are real opportunities for shrinking distance and participating more interactively with young people as they grow. So I think it's appropriate to put in the frame that you just did, which is there are good things and bad things for kids, there are good things and bad things for parents, and the job that we have trying to understand this age is really to separate that wheat from the chaff.
The challenge and that you identify, of course, is the fact that we're dealing with the first generation of digital natives, which of course implies that previous generations were not digital natives and do not have this this upbringing that is infused with technology as a given. And of course, what that leads to is the question of how parents deal with these issues, because both to appreciate the positives, like the creativity that can occur with mashups and with applications that can be downloaded relatively cheaply or perhaps even free through open source and free software and the like, parents might not be able to appreciate not only the creativity and the positive aspects of technology and how they help their children, concern, but perhaps of more concern to parents, they won't sense that there is a threat out there that they need to be aware of. And, you know, the question becomes the role of parents in this situation. You know, you talk in the book about what parents need to be doing in order to stay abreast of technology, and I guess I'll put the question this way. When we think about technology and the interaction that children can have with other individuals, with entities on the internet, don't parents have the same responsibility to keep up with technology just as they would want to keep up with drug issues or with teenage angst and making sure that their children are happy?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the biggest concern I had about parents was those who were just simply checking out of the conversation, who were saying, this is too confusing for me, or I can never keep up with it, and therefore I'm going to write it off, in a sense, either saying to your kids, don't use it at all, which is rarely going to be a good approach for kids, particularly kids as they enter the teenage years, of course. That's a perfect invitation to use it just in ways that you don't want them to, or to say, go ahead and use it, but I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to know anything about it. I'll just pretend it's not happening. I think both of those are not constructive. And I would say that for teachers, the same reaction is often the first one that they have. So I think it is crucial that parents have at least a sense of what's going on in this culture. It's a very, very important part of many young people's lives, the extent to which they interact with one another over digital media, and the way that they relate to institutions and information through similar media. So I think it is essential that parents have a sense of it. I think the harder question is, so what does that mean in reality? Okay, we all agree that you need to be in touch with your kids and how they're leading their lives. What is the way to stay up with it? And
right.
I actually think the best way to do it is to let your young people be your guides, to be open to a conversation where your kids are in fact saying to you, this is what I'm doing, let me show you some of it. Now, that's Pollyanna-ish on some level. There are some kids who just will never do that, and you don't have relationships with them. But that's a nut that you have to crack generally, right, which is to have an open and honest conversation with your kids as much as you possibly can, and to use the ability of young people to teach you as a way to have that conversation. I was just very, very surprised in the interviews we did about how often this came up and how often kids were just delighted to show their parents what they were doing. They'd often do it in the context of, here's what my friend is doing, showing, for instance, a social network profile of one of their friends, not their own. But I think that's okay. That's a way to get into it and to at least to start the conversation.
The darkest point of this issue, and I think we'll approach this tragedy this way before addressing some other issues I'd like to discuss in the remaining about 15 or 16 or so minutes that we have, is this recent situation, this tragedy where a teenager in Florida took his own life on the internet by streaming video of himself overdosing on some combination of pills. The show is being recorded on December 2nd. The story broke within the last couple of weeks. And this is obviously a tragedy. That goes without saying. Are there any lessons or any points that you would take from this situation beyond the obvious warning to parents as well as to children that may not be evident? What's your reaction to that tragedy?
Well, I'm not sure that I have much in the way of insight beyond the some of the obvious, but I think they're worth restating anyway. Obviously, the first and most important is, you know, your heart goes out to the child and their parents and relatives and friends who, you know, endured this tragedy. There really, is sort of no way to say anything good about it. The the things that one might want to learn from it, I think, are several. Picking up on your last point about the need for parents to be in touch with their kids, this was plainly, on some level, a call for help, that there were some warning signs in terms of how this young person had acted in the context of digital media, and he had said certain things that one might consider to be a pattern and a way to kind of to tell what's going on. And was clearly doing in public to some extent, right? And so I think being in touch with the ways in which your kid is speaking and calling out to other people is essential to try to understand if they're trying to tell you something that you're having a hard time hearing or, otherwise they can't just tell you directly. So I think it just emphasizes, it underscores this notion that you need to be understanding the environments in which your kid is acting, and digital media clearly is a big part of that. I think a second one is to say that these kinds of tragedies might be headed off in some cases if, in fact, there's an active community of people who are listening for similar things and intervening. And I don't know, obviously, well enough the details of this particular case to know whether somebody could have seen something and could have intervened in a way that would have helped, or maybe that they were already trying and it just wasn't possible, but really to recognize that all of the good things and all of the bad things that happen in regular offline life are going to play out in these online environments too, and really to treat these as no different, that the young people we talked to considered online and offline activities to be really not any different. It's just life. There's not online life and offline life. So just as we think about how do you help prevent an at-risk kid from harming himself or harming one of his friends or otherwise, you need to just consider the public spaces in the online world to be like public parks, the kinds of places that we need to have policing in the way that we do in real space, and community members who are looking out their window and trying to figure out whether or not somebody's doing something to somebody else and willing to pick up the phone when that's happening. So I think it's essential that parents not only stay in touch with their own kids, but that communities more broadly and police and other support systems are active in these spaces. One particular policy suggestion that we've been working on after writing this book is to think about, what would it be like to have social workers who were in some of these environments, social workers who were maybe even publicly funded, who spent some time in social networking environments and other places, online chat rooms and so forth, who could help identify the most at-risk teens who are expressing themselves in these environments and maybe calling out for help and using these as intervention points. I could imagine a core of young people and professionals working together as social workers or as the equivalent of community type police to be reaching out to people through these environments where those clues are obvious. And obviously that none of this is to say anybody is to blame for this particular tragedy, but to say that we should obviously try to learn from it where we can.
It's obviously, I share, sending out thoughts and prayers to the family of this teen who took his life. In the remaining 10 minutes or so that we have, John, let's talk about one or two other issues relatively quickly, as always, in an hour even. We can only touch tip of the iceberg. But you do mention in your book the more commonly known issues involving piracy and illegal downloading of content on the internet. You mentioned the Napster and the Grokster decisions and the pedagogical function that these decisions serve in terms of making sure that children or those that would download know that, for example, piracy is illegal. But in the context of technology, perhaps I want to ask you what the pedagogical value is of court decisions in this environment that, as Professor Lessig has pointed out, involves code and norms and markets also playing a major role. How do court decisions impact or value or directly address the kinds of decisions that children are making on the internet?
It's a great question. So there's a tricky dynamic with respect to intellectual property. I think many young people do understand that downloading files to which you don't have rights and in the kind of ordinary mode of downloading a copyrighted song is illegal. I think that the effect of the recording industry's very large campaign to sue tens of thousands of young people in the United States and the corresponding international body doing it to tens of thousands abroad, and resulting in specific court decisions in some cases, but mostly in settlements of usually about $3,000, has had an effect in awareness of the extent to which it's illegal. What it hasn't had, as far as I can tell, and this is somewhat contested, but has been a material change in behavior in the sense of many more people doing lawful things against the backdrop of knowing that it is unlawful to download many of these songs, or in the context, for instance, of online videos, not to go to video sharing sites and watch copyrighted television shows there. It is the case that some of these lawful services, like iTunes in the music context, or Hulu in the video context, have had a huge uptick in usage. Of course, that's so. But it's against the backdrop of everybody, young people and older people alike, moving to digital formats and online formats. So you've got a huge rush from the analog world of enjoying music to the online and digital world. And much of the rush is toward the free and illegal modes rather than the free and legal or the paid and legal modes. With many young people, despite the fact that they know it's unlawful. So this is a tricky thing where I guess one answer could be to say, just continue to tell the kids they're bad and that they're breaking the law and continue to sue them until they stop. But I think that's a little bit like saying, you know, the beatings will continue until morale approves. It's not likely to be the most effective way to get young people to act lawfully in this particular context. And so I think it's important that we, as educators, uphold the law and encourage young people to uphold the law. But I think it's also important for us to say, okay, what is really going on here? What's the dynamic? And one of the dynamics is the social norm plainly is in many societies that, yes, it may be illegal, but it's actually okay to be practicing illegal file sharing. And why is it okay? Well, because other people are doing it, because it's sticking it to the man, they have enough money anyway, many of these other kinds of excuses. It's also okay because there's a sense that things on the Internet are victimless-type crimes, so it's not actually harming anyone in particular. These are the kinds of things that we heard from young people. And then again, there is the relatively small number of people who, in fact, think you know, there's some confusion as to lawfulness, that it's legal to do it if, in fact, you get it from a friend rather than get it from a peer-to-peer file sharing network directly, just as one example. So right. I think that's the challenge, is you've got a tension between what the law says and what community norms are, particularly among the young people that we talk to. And the flip side of that I'm equally concerned about is young people don't have a very good sense of what their legal rights are to be able to reuse some of this material. So just as they know it's illegal and they download it, they're very worried about if they do remix it, if they do reuse it in some fashion that in fact is legal, that they may get in more trouble. So I think you've got this very odd dynamic where they're doing the kinds of things that we don't think are so socially constructive, like enjoying music that they don't pay for and where they ought to. On the other hand, they're fearful about using it for the socially constructive things because they don't understand the law that well on that side. So there's a real need, I think, here for some nuanced forms of education that perhaps build on these court cases that you're talking about, but also kind of get to young people and maybe put them in the position of the creator, put them in a position where they understand that if somebody creates something, they do get some rights in it, but also understand that you may make various decisions about how you want somebody else to use it or reuse those materials. I think there are lots of opportunities we have to improve the way kids are taught about this.
We're talking with Professor John Palfrey of Harvard Law School, author of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives with Urs Gasser. John, in the last five or so minutes, of course, I start asking questions that are unfair given the time that we have left, but I ask them anyway. I just plow forward. Let's talk briefly about issues involving social networks and social networking. I mean, we're in a time right now where Facebook is exploding in popularity, and we've seen MySpace and Twitter is becoming more popular, and these sites are not only used, of course, by the first generation of digital natives, but they're used by people that are age-wise far removed from that generation. We see Facebook being used professionally, and literally I've had the odd experience of having among my friends both my wife's first cousins, who are teenage girls, and mentors of mine, other IP professors, which creates an interesting dynamic in and of itself. And I want to ask you about particularly about the monetization of the social networking. Of course, Facebook is a for-profit entity, as are most of the others, if not all of them. What's your reaction? I mean, in the remaining a few minutes that we have, I mean, the equivalent of allowing monitoring and regulation of basic relationships that exist occurring now because of Facebook? People are now making their friends, they're maintaining their friendships, they're creating new relationships through technology, and this technology has a monetized aspect to it. Do you have a concern about that? Is that something we should be concerned about?
This is a very tricky issue because many of the businesses that young people are using, or services that are run by businesses young people are using, are supported by this model of where it's free to use them. There's not an upfront fee, but of course you have to pay for it somehow, which is ordinarily done by advertising, and increasingly companies are getting to know much more about you, and in this era of social networks, the things that they come to know about you are very personal and very detailed, and they're often not just about you, but about how you relate to other people, your social graph, or the broader social graph in which your relationships fall. So this is, as you describe it, exactly what's happening, right? The value of having this information is great to the individual because it makes your social life, work more effectively, and it's a productivity tool and so forth. On the other hand, it's exactly what makes advertising somewhat more precise in terms of reaching an intended audience. I'm not sure that we've gotten to the point at which social networks have found the holy grail. Haven't yet found exactly the way to monetize this, but they're certainly experimenting with it and need to come up with it before their venture capital or the other forms of capital dry up. There are probably some that are more profitable than others, but there are certainly many social networks that still haven't made a whole lot of money and need to do that through advertising. So is it something to be concerned about? I think the answer is yes, that it is something to be concerned about. It's not something to wring one's hands about and not participate at all, but I think it's something to be in a serious conversation about. So why is this so? I think one is a generalized concern about the commercialization of public spaces. If you think about what these social networks are to young people, they are the public parks, or they are the public places in which young people are leading key aspects of their lives, particularly their social lives, and they're leaving a lot of information about themselves in these environments, and they're run by people who are clearly well-meaning right now, but they are businesses that have to profit at some point, and they're doing this in an environment in which they're likely are going to be covered in advertisements, and they're going to be receiving marketing messages in environments where it's not necessarily the purpose of going there. It's quite different from being in a public space that is without advertisements. So that's kind of a generalized fear. I think the more specific fear is to say we don't have particularly good regulations for personally identifiable information in the United States, that there isn't a single privacy law that supports you. It's really about what deal you negotiate with a particular provider. So it might be that you negotiate a perfectly good deal with one social network, but it changes over time, and you've still got lots of information in it. There's a whole lot of trust involved, and so I think both this generalized fear about commercialization of these spaces, and secondly, the fact that you have to place so much trust in private parties whom you don't know, and where we know that kids don't read the privacy policies, they don't read the long legal documents associated with it, and they don't know the people who are holding their data. This is a potentially a real concern down the road. So I'm not so concerned that I say don't use Facebook because they learned something about you, or don't use MySpace, or don't use YouTube. But I do think that young people should be thinking ahead to what are the ramifications of wrapping your life so completely into these environments.
On that point, we've run out of time. And John, I want to thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and discussing your book, Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. I've greatly enjoyed the discussion, and I invite you back on Hearsay Culture to continue it in the future.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you, John. I'm very excited to mention, as we think about the show and where it's going, that the American Bar Association Journal has identified and selected Hearsay Culture as one of the Blog 100 of 2008, one of the top 100 blogs by lawyers for lawyers, which is their description. Of course, Hearsay Culture is aimed at an audience beyond lawyers, but certainly I hope and enjoy having lawyers listening to the show. So I'm very excited to announce that, and I'm thrilled at the honor. I should also mention, and this is a shameless self-promotion, that the ABA Journal website is having voting going on to vote for your favorite blog in 10 different categories, one of which are podcasts. I have four competitors, all of which that are excellent podcasts, and I'd certainly encourage you to listen to those other shows as well. But if you are so inclined, and if you are a lawyer, I would encourage you to vote for Hearsay Culture. And I think the voting closes, from what I've been advised, on January 2nd, 2009. But I thank the ABA Journal editors for the honor of placing Hearsay Culture in the Blog 100 of 2008. This is the last show for the fall quarter on KZSU's schedule. The show will go into hiatus until mid-January, where we will be picking up with a wide variety of guests, both technologists, IP professors, people performing and involved in interesting technological services like the Tor Project, people thinking about intellectual property and technology, law and regulation. And I'm very excited and look forward to having that slate of guests on the show. You can find that list of guests by going to hearsayculture.com, as always. And, of course, you can always listen to the show a variety of ways. Hopefully you will listen to KZSU in the Bay Area at 90.1, or you can stream the show at kzsulive.stanford.edu Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. You can get the show through the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page through iTunes. You can get the show through the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, which is Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage. And, of course, you can always get the show through hearsayculture.com, where you can find all previous shows, the upcoming schedule, and occasional ruminations and thoughts on my part. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. Thank you for your continued support of the show. I look forward to continuing the discussion with a great slate of guests in the beginning of January. I wish you a happy holiday season, and I will look forward to talking with you then. And, of course, please feel free to email me in the interim at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thanks again, and please stay tuned to KZSU. Have a great day.